good horse, I call you my shiny black.
In order to sort of tell a story that helps sell drugs, we are being telling a story that either you have a broken brain, a chemical imbalance, and need drugs for life, or you're normal, right? That's still setting up this line that divides human beings into the fit and the unfit. And you also hear all these stories that they're finding genes for this and that, right? Well, they've been finding genes for that ever since Aaron Rosenthal in 1908 said there was a normal gene and an insane gene.
Give me your best, for you know and I know, good horse amongst the
rest. So, are these medical policies? Are these social policies? And are they social policies? This is the question for you all. I'm pretty sure they're not born of good science, but do they reflect this thing that we as a society are continuing to say that there's this line separating the fit from the unfit, the normal from the abnormal? And I think we still are embracing that same idea, and I think history is telling us it's not a good idea.
You're listening to episode 613 of Unwelcome Guests, The Economic Disposal of the Worthless. I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard Robert Whittaker, author of Mad in America, who's a keen observer of the so-called mental health of Americans, and he's going to be speaking today. We have 2 hours on the hidden history of eugenics in the USA. And eugenics, as we shall hear, was leapt upon by the barons of industry, Rockefeller and the Carnegie Foundations, as a very important idea that the public need to be informed about. And not just informed, thousands of people should be sterilized. Now, although John Taylor Gatto touches on this in The Underground History of American Education, I hadn't stopped to think about the reality of a society with tens or hundreds of thousands of people who are forcibly sterilized, and a legal system that says, well, that's okay, that's constitutional, and a public that acquiesces and says, well, if it's for the good of the race, fair enough. I'm glad to be living in days in which these ideas have been discredited. I feel, in a real sense, that we have another similar phenomenon going on, where the IMF, or so-called financial leaders, market makers, claim the right to decide the fate of millions or even more people based on some obscure ideas about interest rates and repayments. We'll get back to David Graeber, I dare say, next week on debt. Now, this week's presentation from Robert Whittaker shows how would-be leaders have a tendency to take whatever theories they think are going around and use them for their own political ends. Now, the lecture continues into the second hour, and it's followed by a Q&A session. Thank you to Moses Nagel for help with the audio. It's a little bit mucky in the first few minutes, but the audio quality settles down. And this presentation is from 2012.
Tonight we have with us Robert Whittaker. Robert is a journalist and the author of 4 books. Much of his writing is focused on psychiatry, the pharmaceutical industry, and medical histories. His first book, Mad in America, which we were just talking about, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill, was named by Discover Magazine as one of the best science books of 2002. His second book, The Mapmaker's Wife, A True Tale of Love, Murder, and Survival in the Amazon, was named by the American Library Association as one of the best biographies of 2004. In 2008, Crown published his book, On the Lapse of Gods, The Red Summer of 1919, and the Struggle for Justice that Remade a Nation, which was awarded the Anthony J. Lucas Work in Progress Prize. His newest book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America, won the Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for Best Investigative Journalism in 2010. Prior to writing these books, Robert worked as a science and medical reporter at the Albany Times Union newspaper in New York for quite a while. His journalism articles won several national awards, including a George Polk Award for medical writing and a National Association of Science Writers Award for Best Magazine Article. A series he co-wrote for the Boston Globe
was named as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 1998. So we were very fortunate to have Mr. Whitaker.
Thanks very much. It's really nice to be here. I wrote Mad in America in 2002, which is in that book where I wrote about the history of eugenics. So this is the first time I've been talking about this surgery for almost 10 years. So we'll see how much I can remember. Now I have my cheat note and my crib notes here. I think the big picture is this that we'll talk about. I'll talk about 45 minutes and we'll have some time for just discussion. We in the United States, of course, we have this big picture history that sort of governs our society, which is sort of this history of the chosen people. We go back to the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. And we have this sense that society was born with these sort of really profound principles of democracy, etc. And then we do have the sense that we are a people better than other people, so to speak, in our history. The eugenics history tells a different story. It's one of our darkest episodes in American history. It isn't really taught in American schools, but I think it should be taught. It's an important part of our history. It talks about how complicated our history has been. And I'll talk about how that affected care of, quote, mental people with psychiatric problems for the first half of the 20th century. And then we'll talk about whether the sort of eugenic attitudes towards the, quote, mentally ill have really disappeared. Are they still around? Just hidden? That sort of thing. So that's sort of the context for this whole story. So if we go back to where eugenics arose, how this began to infect our society, it of course comes from Charles Darwin as the beginning moment. So in 1859, Charles Darwin publishes Origin of the Species. And of course, what is the story? What are the three points really that you get from Origin of the Species? One is that species evolve. Two, that evolution is driven through a struggle for the survival of the fittest, and the fit therefore pass on their genes. And three, in nature, the unfit are not allowed to, they don't get a chance to procreate. Okay, those are sort of the three principles you see in Origin of Species. Now, Charles Darwin doesn't talk about humans, he's really talking about others, but obviously the implication is that the human species evolved and could evolve in the future. It's not a static place, so to speak, or static species. So Charles Darwin's cousin, named Sir Francis Galton, he sees this, and he's going to become the father of the eugenics movement, idea as a science. Who is Sir Francis Galton? He was born in 1822 to a rich family in Birmingham, England. When he was when in 1844 his father died, he therefore inherited a lot of money and never had to work for a living. Anyway, his cousin's book comes out, and he immediately grasps this idea. He says, if species evolve, and already we have farmers selectively breeding their livestock, right, to improve their pigs and cows and also their plants, etc. So if farmers can do that with their livestock and can do it with their plants, why can't societies do it with humans, is the idea. And so the minute you have this idea, you're going to start to think about who needs to breed and who does not need to breed, so to speak. So what does he say? Could not the race of men be similarly improved? Could not the undesirables be got rid of and the desirables multiplied? So that's his first principle. You hear that? Principle is we're going to start separating society into the desirables. We're going to help them breed. And we're going to have this other group, the undesirables, and we're not going to have them breed. That's the core principle we're going to see play out. But it starts right away with Sir Francis Galton as a key principle of eugenics. So the next thing what he does is he, in 1869, he publishes a scientific work called Hereditary Genes. And what he does is he goes around and he looks at 1,000, I think it's 1,000 people. Yes, prominent English leaders, bankers, scientists, writers, etc. And he finds that those 1,000 people come from a select group of people in England, sort of the upper class. And he says, look, it's just a small group of people that have such accomplishments in our society. And many are closely related. Now, obviously, why is this? Well, he's a perfect example. He doesn't have to work for a living, right? He has a chance to, you know, explore science, etc. Obviously, what he's really seeing is how class-bound the society is. But he doesn't see it that way. He says, these people have better germplasm. That's why they succeed so much, and the rest of people, they don't succeed because they're in essence inferior. And so what does he conclude? He says, this means that he's talking about how humans, if we really look at it, are decidedly unequal. Democratic ideals that men are of, quote, equal value are simply, quote, undeniably wrong and cannot last. Even the ordinary citizen, quote, is too base for the everyday work of modern civilization. So, given this thought, he immediately says, what do we as a society have to do? We have to encourage those with good germplasm to breed and those with bad germplasm not to breed. And here's what he writes. I do not see why any insolence of caste should prevent the gifted class, when they have the power, from treating their compatriots with all kindness, so long as they maintain celibacy. He's talking about the poor, etc. But if these compatriots continue to procreate children inferior in moral, intellectual, and physical qualities, it is easy to believe that the time may come when such persons would be considered as enemies to the state and to have forfeited all claims to kindness. So this is, you can see right away, we're going to distinguish between the fit and the unfit, and those who we're going to call the unfit, A, we don't want them breeding, and two, if they do breed, enemies of the state. So this is a founding principle. And then in 1883, he coins the term eugenics, and it's derived from the Greek word which means well-born, as the science, he says, that would, quote, improve the human stock by giving, quote, the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable than they otherwise would have had. And what he's saying is here, society has to support the rich and in this Darwinian struggle for survival, we've got to give them extra advantages and help them breed. And those who are, quote, cacogenic or badly born, we have to suppress their breeding impulse. And this is the founding moment of the eugenics movement in 1883. Now, he's English, but where eugenics will first get a root in academic communities and will first have social policies enacted, it's in the United States, not in England. And why does it find such fertile soil here? Well, in the 1880s, 1890s, when these ideas are being promoted, the U.S. is changing a lot. Really, if you look at the population early on, it's a very white Anglo-Saxon Protestant group. But going in the late 1700s, of course, we have slaves and we have a black population, but it's a very WASPy population initially. And they're, of course, at the top of the heap. Starting in the 1850s and on, we get a lot of immigration. We get Jews, we get Italians, we get Irish, we get Slavs, etc., and all of a sudden the country is becoming more Catholic, and not just Protestant, and not just, quote, old English white. So that ruling class here feels threatened by the immigrations, basically. We also have, of course, in the 1880s, the freedmen. So that we, of course, we're at the Civil War, we've got 4.5 million blacks that have been freed, so the country seems to be changing rapidly. So it is picked up, and in the first sort of eugenic tract you see published in the United States is published in 1891 by a feminist, an American feminist named Virginia Woodhull. She publishes a book called The Rapid Multiplication of the Unfit. She writes, the best minds of the day agree that, quote, imbeciles, criminals, paupers, and the otherwise unfit must not be bred. For that to occur, she notes, the unfit have to be prohibited from marrying, segregated into asylums, and forcibly sterilized. So as early as 1891, she's setting out a social agenda for sort of preventing the unfit from breeding. Now what will then happen is eugenics will begin to take hold and be accepted as a legitimate science over the next 20, 30 years. And we'll see how it happens that it becomes accepted as a science. The first step, and by the way, the funding for the development of this science comes from the industrial titans of America at the time. It comes from Andrew Carnegie. It comes from John D. Rockefeller Jr. And in particular, it also comes from a Mary Harriman, who's the widow of a railroad magnate, Edward Harriman. So the founding moment is 1904. Andrew Carnegie provides funds to a man named Charles Davenport to establish in Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island, quote, the name of the group is going to be the Center for the Study of Human Evolution. And again, it's to be a eugenics center. Now, who is Charles Davenport? He is of WASP heritage. He's Harvard educated. Now, remember, it's 1904, and he would like to boast that his people have been in America for 300 years. I'm not sure how they've been here for 300 years, but that's what he would boast. So what is the first thing that Charles Davenport begins to say? Well, he begins to say that human traits are passed down in the same way that eye color is. So we get in the 18, I forget exactly when, Gregor Mendel, the Austrian monk who says that certain characteristics come in gene pairs. Let's say with his pea plants. So you have a gene, let's say, for a tall pea plant, a gene for a short pea plant. If the a tall gene is the dominant gene and you have a tall and short gene, the plant is tall. If you have two short genes, then the plant is short. Okay, that's this old Mendelian genetics. And he says human behaviors, he makes the claim, are handed down in the same way, in these sort of simple gene pairs. So he says, for example, you have gene pairs for nomadism, shiftlessness, insincerity. And again, these are gene pairs. And immigrants from Southern European, he says, inherited genes that made them, quote, more given to crimes of larceny, kidnapping, assault, murder, rape, and sex immorality. Jews inherited genes for thieving and prostitution. So again, basically, you would see these different immigrant groups said to have certain behavioral characteristics, and it's genetic in kind. But what are we starting to do here? We're also starting to rank people by fit and unfit. And so who's going to be at the bottom of this list? Well, it's going to be blacks, it's going to be the freedmen, and at the very bottom is going to be the insane. But that's what we're going to start doing. We're going to start ranking people in this way. Now, going forward, in 1910, at Cold Harbor, they established the Eugenics Record Office. The purpose of the Eugenics Record Office was to go out into American society and start, in the manner of a census, figuring out who are the, quote, cacogenic, the unfit in American society. So they trained, I think it was 258 field workers who then went out into prisons. They went out into asylums. And they just went out into communities and tried to figure out what percent of the population have genes unfit to be passed on. And this effort was again funded by Mary Harriman. And in 4 years, yes, they had made a conclusion, and they set out their sterilization agenda. They concluded, and the group that concluded this, that was part of the Cold Spring Harbor group, the Eugenics Record Office, the group was named the Committee to Study and to Report on the Best Practical Means of Cutting Off the Defective Germplasm in the American Population. And they concluded that 10% of the American population needed to be sterilized. This is in 1914. Now, just to give you an idea, we tend to think that eugenics wasn't popular with the American people. As we go forward, we're going to see the majority of Americans believed in eugenic policies. But here's what Teddy Roosevelt, the great populist, said in response to this report that 10% of Americans needed to be sterilized. He says, and this is what he writes to the committee that put forth this. He says, at present, there is no check to the fecundity of those who are subnormal. So he's embracing this idea that 10% need to be sterilized. Now, going forward, what happens? By 1914, when this report is issued, there are 44 colleges in America that are now teaching eugenics in their curriculums. As in the same way they might teach physics, they might teach mathematics, they'll teach eugenics in their science department. These classes are particularly pronounced at the Ivy Leagues, Harvard, Cornell, Brown, etc. Why? Because they're bastions, of course, of WASP privilege at this time. So it's going to be an Ivy League nurtured science. MIT does it as well. They also begin to have the American Genetics Association starts a journal called the Journal of Heredity. And now the scholars begin publishing research articles on this. They talk about the birth rates of the unfit and how they have high birth rates. You'll see articles lamenting how WASP are not procreating nearly as fast as the unfit. And there's even articles about how the daughters of, the pilgrims or the American Revolution are particularly bad at procreating. And you'll see things like this. Here's an article that likens immigrants to a bacterial invasion. There's another article titled The Menace of the Half-Man, in which the writer concludes that if the country could get rid of its defectives, then, quote, human misery in a well-ordered country like America will be more than cut in half. And just to, by 1924, more than 9,000 papers on eugenics had been published in academic journals. 9,000 papers. So again, there's a lot of people researching and writing on this. Finally, also, the Eugenics Research Association, they had their own research association, they boasted in 1924 that 119 of 383 members were fellows of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the nation's most prestigious scientific group. Point is, these are mainstream scientists in many ways that are pushing this agenda. So we get a seed planted in the 1880s, right? We see Virginia Woodhull talk about this. Then we see funding by the industrial titans for the Eugenics Record Office at Cold Spring Harbor. Then we see it taken up as science. So what happens in the 1920s? We now have to sell eugenics to the population as a whole. This is the next step. Now, this begins really with the... In 1921, I think, is the founding moment of really selling it to the population. And at that point, at that time, in New York City, at the American Museum of Natural History, there's the Second International Congress on Eugenics, and this meeting is funded in part by the Carnegie Institution and the Rockefeller Foundation. Here's how the conference was kicked off by the museum president, Henry Fairfield Osborne. He says, "It is time for science, quote, to enlighten government in the preventing of the spread and multiplication of worthless members of our society." So that's the comment that is at the American Museum, the Natural Museum of History. Now, this conference lasted for 3 days. People from MIT, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Princeton, Cornell, etc., gave presentations of their papers. And again, it was about the rapid multiplication of the unfit and the lack of multiplication of the very fit. And here's some of the talks. They gave talks on the Jewish problem, quote, the dangers of Negro-white intermixture, and so forth. Now, this sounds extreme, right? It sounds crazy. Do you know what happened to the exhibits at that conference, where they were then sent for the next 3 months? To the American Capitol. So they went to the American Capitol and were on display there for 3 months. My point of this is, if they go to the American Capitol, this is not seen as crazy stuff, right? This is seen as mainstream science. Now, after that meeting, here's what the New York Times editorialized after this meeting at the Natural Museum of History. They write this: "Civilization, as now organized, does not leave nature as fresh as she has been in the past to procure the survival of the fit. Modern philanthropy, working hand in hand with modern medical science, is preserving many strains which in all preceding ages would have been inexorably eliminated." Strains of human beings. "While life has become easier in the lower ranges, it has become more difficult for the well-born and the educated, who pay for modern philanthropy and an ever-lessening ability to afford children of their own." This is why they're not procreating. They're taking so much time caring for the unfit. "There is a very serious question whether the 20th century will be able to maintain and pass onward the infinitely intricate and specialized structure of civilization created by the 19th century." Again, this is a New York Times editorial saying that this has merit. Now, in the wake of that conference, the organizers of that conference, Charles Davenport and other mainstream eugenicists, said, "We need to form a national eugenics society, an American eugenics society." And so they've now said this was on our drawing board. And as a first step, they said, "We're going to recruit 99 famous or well-known scientists to be an advisory council." And they send out a letter to the best scientists of the country. And in this letter, you can see, they warn of, quote, racial deterioration and the need to, quote, to resist the, quote, complete destruction of the white race. This is how they're recruiting scientists. And they said, "If we adopt eugenics policies, quote, our burden of taxes can be reduced by decreasing the number of degenerates, delinquents, and defectives supported in public institutions." So they recruit an advisory council. And who is this advisory council? They are an elite group. From 1923 to 1935, more than half were graduates of Ivy League universities. 9 college presidents served on the council. They also had people serving on the council who were from leaders of the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Neurological Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So again, it's mainstream scientists. Now, finally, in 1926, 5 years after that conference, the American Eugenics Society is officially formed. It's funded in part by John D. Rockefeller and George Eastman of Eastman Kodak fame. It grows into a national organization with chapters in 28 states. What is the purpose of the American Eugenics Society? It is now to educate the public, to put out education materials about how eugenics is a science and basically how we have to have the fit breed and the unfit not breed. And remember, at the core of this is a sterilization strategy, that we're going to sterilize the unfit and keep them from breeding. So what did they do? One of the things they did is they developed traveling exhibits. And by the way, I have some of the, I didn't have slides here. If you want to see some of the pictures of this, you can go to a website that I have, robertwhitaker.org, and you just click on the book Mad in America, and you'll see some of these eugenic exhibits on there, some slides, etc. So one of the exhibits they went to, you know, schools and county fairs was called Some People Are Born to Be a Burden on the Rest. And what it had was a thing with lights that flashed. And like every 15 seconds, a light would flash, and that meant that society was spending so much money on the unfit. And then every 30 seconds, a light would flash, and it said another degenerate has now been born. I think the actual word is defective, excuse me. And then finally, there was one light over here that hardly ever blinked. After 7.5 minutes, it would finally blink. And that was a sign that somewhere in the United States, a high-grade person had finally been born. So this went, to exhibits, etc. Another exhibit that they would have as part of their traveling exhibits was to explain that certain characteristics were inherited in the same way as eye color was, or, you know, plant size, etc. So they would have these things, you know, showing eye color. If you had, like blue and brown is the dominant. And, you know, the whole thing about if you get one gene for blue, one for brown, you're brown-eyed, and you need two for blue. Well, basically, they had a thing saying the same thing about all sorts of human characteristics. And we'll talk about mental illness, but basically, one of the things they had is you could either have an insane gene or a normal gene. If you had both, you were normal, but you were a carrier. But if you got two insane genes, then you were insane. So it was a simple Mendelian gene thing that was handed down. By the way, well, this is a bit of a side. At these, if you could go back to the fairs at this time, so these things would come and they would have this traveling exhibit about how some people are born to be a burden on the rest. They would also have fitter family contests. So you know how in county fairs they will have the best pig and the best cow and etc. and you compete to have the best pumpkin. Well, families would also bring their family histories and compete in the family fairs to be named the fittest family. And at the end of the fair, they would actually have parades sometimes where they would have the fittest stock. And they would have the pigs and the cows, and then the fittest family would be riding in a car. And there are pictures of that. And the cars would often call this the state's best crop of the family that was the fittest family. What else did the American Eugenics Society do? They tried to recruit the clergy to give a eugenics message. And they would award ministers and all who gave the best eugenics sermon cash prizes for giving this message that we are not born equal. And here's, for example, in 1928, the winner was a Reverend William Mason. And he won the top prize that year by telling his congregation, quote, that modern science had proven that all men are created unequal. And he says, trying to lift up the unfit with education and social programs is, quote, like attempting to grow better alfalfa with dandelion seed. Can't do it. He explained, we may raise a pig in the parlor, but he remains a pig. And this won the best sermon of the year. They also put out a pamphlet called Tomorrow's Children. It was 137 pages. This urged Americans to think of the American Eugenics Society as, quote, a society for the control of social cancer, with sterilization the way to do so. The pamphlet said, crime and dependency keep on increasing because new defectives are born, just as new cancer cells remorselessly penetrate into sound tissue. So you can see what happened over this time. We get Darwin, then we get Sir Francis Galton with saying that there's this new science out there, eugenics, that's going to help human societies evolve. Very simple idea. You got to have the quote, fit breed and the unfit not breed. You can see how contrary that is to basically what we believe are American principles, all men are created equal. We then get it sort of nurtured by rich people in this country as a science. And then by the 20s and 30s, there's this effort to convince the American population this is a good science. And so that's what goes on. So now let's see what I'll do is I'll talk about how these eugenic ideas affected the mentally, quote, you know, those diagnosed as mentally ill, and a little bit as how it affected, African-Americans, blacks as well, okay? And then we'll go forward from there. So we talked about Mendelian characteristics. Davenport, in 1904, when he goes there to the Cold Spring Harbor and has the Society for the Study of Evolution, etc., he commissions a man named Aaron Rosenhoff, who's at King's Hospital, I think, here in New York, etc., to do a study of the insane. And it's Aaron Rosenhoff that indeed finally concludes that there's an insane gene and a normal gene. And the way he does this is this science. He looks at 72 hospitalized patients, and he looks at the offspring of 1,097 relatives of these 72 hospitalized patients. Now, initially, he finds that only about, I think it's like, it's just a small number seem to be insane. And it doesn't fit his story about a simple Mendelian gene. So what does he do? He goes and looks at these relatives, and he starts saying, well, you're a little bit agitated. You count as mentally ill. And he just expands the boundaries. You've been sad. You're mentally ill. Until he gets a number of the 1,097, he concludes that 351 are mentally ill. It's right on the number if you believe in Mendelian genetics. So he comes out, he says this. Now this gets published in textbooks, that this is the latest science that has been found. Even though there were some people who said, this is the most ludicrous thing we've ever heard in our life. But here's the key thing. See how specific this does when you have Mendelian things? You're either normal or you're abnormal. We're going to say that there's this dividing line between people. It's not that you can have some psychiatric distress. It's who you are. Okay, you see that? And the New York Times editorialized, partly as a result of this understanding, it is certain that the marriage of two mental defectives ought to be prohibited. Because if they're carriers of a single gene, they will pass on that defective gene. All right, now how about social policy towards... What's that? That was in 1923, at this time this whole idea of enacting social policy. So what are the social policies that were enacted towards the mentally ill? Well, the first thing is they're going to prevent the, quote, the insane from marrying. They're going to establish laws. Now, the first state to establish such a law was Connecticut in 1896, 5 years after Virginia Woodhull did that. And by 1933, there was no state left in the country where the insane could legally marry. So how did this work? You went to your clerk, asked for your marriage license, and there was a little thing you had to say, are you insane? If you said you were insane, you weren't allowed to marry. But what the eugenicists noticed is very few people checked on the I am insane box. As the eugenicists complained, they are biased in favor of themselves. So, what did they have to do? The marriage laws weren't working. They had to segregate the, quote, mad, the insane, in asylums. So now, if we think of mental hospitals, the old asylums. Now, if you go back to the original meaning of the word asylum, it's actually a nice meaning. It's like a refuge from sort of the difficulties of life. It's an asylum for that. You go there, you get nurtured back to health, etc., and then you come back. But now what we're going to do is, the idea is we will lock up the defectives and we will keep them there through their breeding years. And so, for example, you can hear this comment from eugenicists in 1914. It is coming, I think, to be generally conceded that permanent segregation, at least during the period of reproductive capacity, is the preferred solution. Okay, we're going to put them away and we're going to prevent them from breeding. Now, you can see that it is during this eugenics era that we get the arise of the population in state mental hospitals. In 1880, there were 31,000 people in the United States in state and county mental hospitals, basically state mental hospitals. And if you look at that number, many of them, in fact, are people that we would say have Alzheimer's today. Okay, it's basically they're serving as nursing homes often. It's end-stage dementia, and it's also related to syphilis. Syphilis, if you, untreated syphilis, which was unsyphilis this time, it ends up in dementia, lots of bizarre things. So a lot of people here are there ill with neurological disorders. 31,000. But now we're going to say we're going to lock up the mentally ill. And by 1940, 60 years later, we had 419,000 patients in state hospitals. So we went from 31,000 to 419. You can also look at what was happening to first episode patients. Prior to 1880, those that were just coming in for first episode of psychosis, they generally got released. They were there for 12 months, 18 months. Now, once we get the eugenics era, they just aren't released anymore. You start being people going in at younger ages, and they just stay there. And you can see also, there's a great book called The Lives They Left Behind. Have any of you heard this book? It's a book in which they went, a state hospital was closed, and people left behind basically suitcases that were filled with their notes, their personal items, etc. So researchers went into those suitcases and they put back together a picture of the lives of people who were getting hospitalized in 1910, 1920, 1930, etc. And I'm telling you, it was immigrants acting differently, that sort of thing. You didn't have to be too crazy to be locked up in a hospital and just kept there. So anyway, that's what they've done there. So, and because of this, by the end of 1920s, you'll see in the Journal of Heredity, eugenicists saying this, segregation of the insane is now fairly complete. So you saw it as a social policy. But now what's a more permanent solution? It's sterilization, right? If we sterilize them, then they can't pass on their bad genes. In 1914, remember, we need to sterilize 10% of the American population. That's the idea. Well, the first state to pass a compulsory sterilization law was Indiana in 1907. And over the next 20 years, 30 state legislatures passed such laws. Now, initially, however, a lot of the laws were vetoed by governors, and there was a lot of opposition to these forced sterilization laws. Who did the opposition come from? Catholics, Jews, anyone who wasn't a WASP, basically, right? So this made it, really, the society was quite uneasy about this, and there really weren't many sterilizations done initially, except in California. For whatever reason, it did start to happen more there. Then in 1920, so the big question is this constitutional? Does the state have a right to forcibly sterilize people? And it comes up before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1927 in a case called Buck versus Bell. And by an 8-1 vote, the United States Supreme Court says it is constitutional. States have the right to forcibly sterilize people. Here's what they wrote. We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent being swamped with incompetence. It is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime, or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. So that's what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled by 8-1 in 1927. And after this, forced sterilizations in the United States do take off. And in the 1930s, we're sterilizing about 2,200 people per year, adults in this country. By the end of World War II, 45,000 people had been sterilized, and about half of those were people in the state hospitals, okay, confined populations. Now, sterilization does not completely end in 1945, but it tapers off, and of course the reason it tapers off is the horrors of Nazi Germany come out, and that's clearly a eugenics policy. What would be the final solution? Kill them, right? If we just killed the unfit. Now, generally, there wasn't much discussion of this, but it was talked about in certain corners. As early as 1911, Charles Davenport, remember, he's the Harvard-educated person who was the first given funds to establish the eugenics office in Cold Spring Harbor. He wrote this in a book. He says that if a society has to choose between allowing the unfit to procreate or killing them, the latter is the preferable option. So here at this scientific thing, they're saying this is a possibility. In 1916, Madison Grant, who was a wealthy New York attorney and one of the founders eventually of the American Eugenics Society, wrote a book called The Passing of the Great Race, and he says this: "The laws of nature require the obliteration of the unfit, and human life is valuable only when it is of use to the community or race." So he's setting up the possibility that maybe we need to kill people.
It's 1916.
Now here I found something in the New York Times to say that this idea was not totally beyond the pale. So in 1921, Connecticut legislators began debating a law for euthanasia of the mentally ill, the hopelessly mentally ill. And they had the legislators tour an insane asylum, and they were given a tour of one person who was manacled to the wall, and the New York Times reported on it in this way. Here's what the law was due. Here's what the New York said. Connecticut legislators are contemplating passing a law, quote, that would provide that persons found to be hopelessly insane after observation and examination of experts should be put to death as mercifully as possible, perhaps by poison. You can read the headline. They talk about the legislators going, seeing this man who's presented them, and the headline is exhibited as case for merciful extinction. All I'm saying is, this is in a paper, as if this is something to be discussed. Now, after this, remember what's happening at this time, okay? This is the time that the American Eugenics Society is trying to educate people that certain people are social cancers, etc. And now we get discussion of human beings with language over the next 15 years by eugenicists that is just astonishing. Here's how you'll see the unfit referred to in various eugenic publications. You can hear them described as social wastage, malignant biological growths, poisonous slime. Those are some of the terms given. Then in the 1930s, Harvard's Ernest Houghton, I think he's a professor of anthropology, writes, "The unfit, quote, are specimens of humanity who really ought to be exterminated." This is a Harvard professor. Finally, in 1935, Alexis Carrel, he's a Nobel Prize-winning physician at Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research on the east side here. He writes a book that is reviewed by the New York Times and other mainstream publications called Man the Unknown. And he writes this: "Gigantic sums are now required to maintain prisons and insane asylums and protect the public against gangsters and lunatics. Why do we preserve these useless and harmful beings? The abnormal prevent the development of the normal. This fact must be squarely faced. Why should society not dispose of the criminals and insane in a more economical manner?" He goes on and he says, "At least any insane person who commits a crime," he concludes, "should be humanely and economically disposed of in small euthanasic institutions supplied with proper gases." So that's in 1935. Now we know where this is going to happen, but now let's go back. In 1925, Adolf Hitler writes his book Mein Kampf, right? And he basically says eugenics is the public health approach that will restore Germany to its greatness. And you know what is happening here. We have World War I, Germany loses a lot of men, and it's also sort of impoverished. Germany wants to rebuild, and Adolf Hitler is saying in Mein Kampf, it's eugenics that will bring us back to a strong nation. Now, the very year he writes that tract, Americans, most notably the Rocker Foundation, give money to Germany to found a eugenics institute in Munich. This very same year it's written. So they give $2.5 million to establish the Psychiatric Institute in Munich, which becomes Germany's leading center for eugenic research. So German eugenics policies will be funded by us. So they gave them money to found this institute that will pursue eugenic policies in not Germany. That's 1925 it gets established. Now Hitler comes to power in 1933, and one of the first things they want to do, Hitler, since he has a eugenics agenda, is to start sterilizing the mentally ill. Okay, and they want to pass a law. So what they do is, they come to the United States, since we've been doing it, they send their scientists, and particularly they go to California to look at how we sterilize people here. You know, they're going to learn from us. And so, in fact, they do so. They go back, and actually Germany, when it sets up its sterilization program, believe that they're doing it in a much more, what's the word for it? Careful way, legal way. They set up a due process mechanism. The mentally ill will be hauled off to heredity courts. They will be deemed defective, and they'll be sterilized. The point is, it's a legal process. It's not just an ad hoc process. Now, when they pass this comprehensive sterilization bill, here's what American eugenicists say. They note with pride, this law was formulated only after careful study of the California experiments. Also, when Nazi Germany passes its comprehensive sterilization bill, it is applauded by the New England Journal of Medicine, the American Public Health Association, and the New York Times. The New York Times, talking about Germany's new law, cites it as an example of a progressive modern public health system. Here's what the New York Times writes. Germany is, quote, just following the path of, quote, other civilized nations, most notably the United States, where, quote, some 15,000 unfortunates have been harmlessly and humanely operated upon to prevent them from propagating their own kind. That's New York Times responding to Germany passing its sterilization law. Now, once Germany does this, they get ahead of the United States. They start sterilizing quite a few. Over the next 6 years, they sterilize 375,000 people. And as this happens, you will see some American eugenicists complaining that Germany is now beating us at our own game, that's a quote, and thereby making herself a stronger nation. So they sterilize 375,000 people. And then in January of 1940, they begin, Germany I'm talking about, killing the mentally ill. And this actually is the precursor, of course, to the Holocaust and the killing of Jews, etc. So why do they start killing the mentally ill in January of 1940? And by the way, psychiatrists are involved in this, German psychiatrists. Well, Germany invades Poland in September 1939, right? They now need the food for soldiers and all. And you can see, literally, basically, these mentally ill are useless eaters, and we now need to start killing them. So they begin a killing process with proper gases, just as Alexis Carroll had said might be good, in January 1940. And over the course of the next 18 months, they kill about 70,000 mentally ill patients. At that point, these small facilities for gassing people are dismantled. They're sent to the east of Germany, and there they're rebuilt for, you know, to start killing the Jews, etc. But the Holocaust begins with the mentally ill. And you can see why. They're seen as the most unfit in society, the most useless eaters. And Germany, even, you see researchers, as they're killing mentally ill, they'll even calculate how much bread is being saved, and that sort of thing. Do you see how the Holocaust is the sort of end result of a long line of thinking? It's a long line of thinking that begins with some people are unfit and enemies of the state. It goes back to that very first thing by Sir Francis Galton. And then if you want to trace the path that leads to the Holocaust, I think you do have to say it comes to the United States, the seed of eugenics. It gets nurtured as a science here. It gets promoted to the United States, the population here. It's titans of American industry that funded here and then helped fund it in Germany as well. The point is, there's a logic here in which it was developed under the cover of science. That's really the tragedy here. It was seen as a public health initiative, and it goes to this horrible end. Now, of course, we in the United States did not start killing our mentally ill. However, if you read in what happens to mental hospitals in the 1930s and 1940s, you will see the amount spent on mental hospitals drops and drops and drops. And you can say, okay, it's the depression, states are, you know, they're running out of money. That's true. But you can see how much is being spent on prisoners and how much is being spent on the mentally ill in mental hospitals, and much more is being spent on prisoners. Okay, so there's in essence a designation going there. The mentally ill are the most worthless. Because of this, you see, the facilities really fall into disrepair. And at the end of World War II, a journalist by the name of Albert Deutsch, first in an essay in Life magazine and then in a book called The Shame of the States, he goes around with a photographer and he just documents what it's like in the state mental hospitals in this country. He takes pictures too. And in the photos you'll see people sitting around naked in some cases. You'll see basically, the places are deteriorated, sometimes feces just on the floor not being picked up, etc. And here's what he writes. And Byberry, by the way, is a mental hospital in Philly, I think. As I passed through some of Byberry's wards, I was reminded of the Nazi concentration camps at Belsen and Buchenwald. I entered buildings swarming with naked humans, herded like cattle, and treated with less concern, pervaded by a fetid odor so heavy, so nauseating, that the stench seemed to have almost a physical existence of its own. I saw hundreds of patients living under leaking roofs, surrounded by moldy, decaying walls, and sprawling on rotting floors for want of seats or benches. All I'm saying is, if you go to the mental hospitals, the shame of the states here, okay, the country does have a lot of financial pressures. But one of the reasons the state hospitals fall into such disrepair is because we have devalued these people as unfit, okay, and that they're really a burden on society. So that's the mainstream story of eugenics as it plays out from around, well, really, 1859, Darwin is to 1945, okay? What happens, of course, is after 1945 is eugenics becomes a shamed science. We associate it with Nazi Germany, and we really don't want to look at how the U.S. in any way was involved with it and nurtured it. I want to do a couple more things here. So we have this sense of the mentally ill being prevented from marrying, segregated in asylums, sterilized, and also said to be poisonous slime, etc., etc. What sort of medical treatments are brought into the mental hospitals while we have this conception of the mentally ill as essentially worthless human beings? Well, first of all, if you read the medical texts, sterilization is now promoted as something helpful for the mentally ill. And because think if you're a doctor, right? If you're a doctor, whatever you do, you need to think of it as helpful for the person. You just have to. So what doctors will start saying is, by sterilizing these people, we remove from them the burden of their being anxious that they might one day have children. So it's sort of an anti-anxiety treatment. But what happens in the 1930s? We get a group of therapies that were even dubbed brain-damaging therapies at the time. One was metrazole convulsive therapy. Metrazole is a poison. It would cause people to have these extraordinary seizures. People would break their backs. They would break other bones. They would break their teeth sometimes. And what happened was a couple of things. One, of course, in terms of helping behavior, people would do anything not to have metrazole convulsive therapy. So just the fear of it was seen as helpful. But also it did cause brain damage. Okay, and then when people came out of this convulsive therapy, they would be sort of like children. They would be needy. They would also be stunned, etc. So we had a therapy. So instead of ranting and whatever with their wild thoughts, they would come out of these convulsive therapies and be more childlike, needy, quiet, that sort of thing. Okay. And by the way, you wouldn't just get one metrazole treatment. You'd get multiple treatments. Another one of these brain-damaging therapies introduced at the same time was insulin. Oh, by the way, one small thing. The rationale for metrazole convulsive theory was that by causing seizures, seizures were seen to be antithetical to schizophrenia. As an antidote to schizophrenia, the idea was that seizures would somehow drive the schizophrenia out. That was the idea. Another therapy at this time was called insulin coma therapy. So they would give people shots of insulin. Of course, that would withdraw so much sugar from the body, they would go into a hypoglycemic coma. And then when they would come out of that, what would happen? The patients, again, would be sort of childish, helpless, quieter, that sort of thing. And again, though, to make it stick, you'd have to give them multiple insulin comas. At autopsy, they would show that there were lesions in the brain associated with insulin coma, etc. Then finally, we get electroshock therapy. Electroshock actually is initially developed as a way, as a replacement for metrazole convulsive therapy, as a way to more reliably induce seizures. Again, they would give multiple rounds of ECT. And again, someone coined these brain damaging therapeutics. And here is the important thing. I'm going to read this sentence. Given that the mentally ill were seen as having not really any worth, any intrinsic worth, the idea was that lowering them to a childlike state, a less intelligent state, was okay. Okay? Because they're going to be less bothersome, and plus they were not seen as having value as who they were. So you will read at the time, here's from a famous psychiatrist at the time, Abraham Myerson. I think it may be true that these people have, for the time being at any rate, more intelligence than they can handle. And the reduction of intelligence is an important part of the curative process. I say this without cynicism. The fact is that some of the very best cures that one gets are in those individuals whom one reduces almost to amentia. Amentia is another word for simple-mindedness. Okay, so you can see in this there is a transformation of being happening, sort of a lowered intelligence, but that is seen as good because it knocks out these delusions, these thoughts, etc., and they're now behave more childlike and less aggressive. The question, I think, is this. Does that happen if we do not have eugenic ideas of the mentally ill? In other words, unless we devalue who they are. Now, it's at this time that frontal lobotomy comes into asylum medicine. What is frontal lobotomy? And it's invented by a Portuguese surgeon named Egas Moniz. Imagine I have two brains. I have a human brain and an ape brain. They will look virtually the same except for one thing. In the human brain, the frontal lobes will protrude. Okay, so this is seen as the part of the brain that makes us human. So in frontal lobotomy, the way it's done initially, they would put in basically a scalpel on this side and this side. So imagine scalpels going in on each side. And then they would just, say here, and then they would just run the scalpel up and down. So they would cut off the front of the lobes. Now initially what they would do is they'd just cut off a little sliver of the frontal lobes. And if that did not produce the desired change in being, they'd do it again and they'd cut off more of the frontal lobes and they would just keep retreating until they got more, you know, enough of the frontal lobes. The neurologist that really became the Pied Piper of frontal lobotomy in this country was Walter Freeman. He came from he was a neurologist at both Georgetown Medical School and George Washington Medical School in D.C. And he developed a new technique for doing prefrontal lobotomies very fast. He developed something called transorbital lobotomy. What he would do is he would lie someone flat on a bed or a cot or something, and then with a hammer, he would have ice picks. Imagine I'm here, and he would just drive the ice picks up into the brain through the eyes. And so he became able to scramble the frontal lobes in about 15 minutes. And he would go around every summer with his station wagon, and he would pull into a state asylum, a state mental hospital, and the superintendent would line up 15, 20 people who were candidates for frontal lobotomy, and he would do 20 operations in the course of a morning. And he would even do it, in order to make them faster, he would drive the ice picks into each eye and then pull them up at the same time, and this way he could do it faster and faster. Now, here is what the master of frontal lobotomy said this surgery did. He, the patient, is freed from anxiety and from feelings of inferiority. He loses interest in himself, both as to his body and as to his relationship with his environment, no longer caring whether his heart beats or his stomach churns, or whether his remarks embarrass his associates. His interests turn outward, and obsessive thinking is abolished. There is something childlike in the cheerful and unself-conscious behavior of the operated patient. You see how they say they're unself-conscious anymore? The reason is it's really the frontal lobes that give us self-consciousness. This is the part of the brain that allows us to sort of think about, you know, step outside and see who we are. So you take that away, and that's basically what he's talking about here.